I'm Sophie Natto, and you're listening to the second season of The Middle. If you're a media geek and work in public relations, journalism, or marketing, you're in the right place.
Will this horrible year never end?
We've never lost a year before, and I'll be damned if we're going to lose one on my shift.
It's that time of year. Time to look back on the news stories and PR snafus that had us all talking and tweeting. What can we learn, and what is ahead in 2020? Brad Ross is the Chief Communications Officer for the City of Toronto. A PR expert with several decades of experience, he's also handled communications for the Toronto Transit Commission. El-Amin Abdelmahmoud is a news curation and social media editor for BuzzFeed News. He writes columns for several other Canadian publications and co-hosts Party Lines, a podcast about Canadian politics for the CBC. Thanks, guys, for joining me on the last show of 2019.
It's finally over.
It has been a long year, hasn't it, Brad? I feel like a long year.
Actually, I don't know where the year went.
Yeah.
But I say that every year. So as you get older, the years get shorter, I think.
Oh, that's lovely. Something to look forward to, El-Amin.
I don't know if it's just you, though. Like, I think it's just time. Like, I think this decade and this year has just kind of messed with my brain in general. Like, I don't know if we're meant to receive this many pieces of information every day. And, like, I feel like every single day I need to come home and, like, empty my brain out. And, like, I don't remember what happened yesterday, what happened last week. Yeah. So just kind of all melding into, like, I can sort of vaguely remember this.
Yeah, maybe 2019 will go down as a year of news fatigue, perhaps. I know I'm really tired.
You know, latest tweets versus top tweets, I'm completely confused by them all now. All running into each other.
Yeah, I hear you.
Well, to help us sort of navigate the year a little bit, I went back to our insights and analytics team. That's our research team here at Edelman. And I asked them to give me a list of the most engaging stories of the year. So these are stories that Canadians shared with each other, tweeted, talked about. And the top 10 list is really interesting. So any guesses as to what the number one on the list might be? Any guesses?
The election.
See, so logically, you would think maybe Trump or the election, right? But no, the number one most engaging story this year was Bianca Andreescu winning the U.S. Open and being the first Canadian to claim the Grand Slam.
I was going to guess the humbled player who recovered.
So that's also in the list. So number two is...
Do you remember the Raptors in this?
So also not on this list. So number two is, remember that guy who I was pissed off that his picture was used to represent all hipsters? And then he figured out, and he wanted to sue MIT Technology Review for using what he thought was his picture. And then he realized that it was somebody else entirely. Do you remember that story?
I did not see that story.
So that's number two. Number three is a 2-year-old terrier mix that was chosen to play the tramp in Disney's live action Lady and the Tramp. This is the list, guys. Number four is the NFL celebrating Michael Vick as Pro Bowl captain despite his past with his dog fighting.
Are any of these stories stressful? Like, I'm like, these are all like pretty happy stories so far.
Yeah.
Well, not the Michael Vick one, I guess.
No, but not the Michael Vick. And then so now the fifth story is the hockey player from the Humboldt Broncos who went to Thailand to get the surgery, the experimental surgery to see. So, I mean, in those top five, guys, like, there's no actual news. Why? What's happening?
So what is the source of this?
So we went and we researched through our systems what the most engaging stories were this year. So not Pure Reach, but the ones that people shared on social, the ones that created the most conversation. Mm. So they're the conversation pieces of the year.
I mean, top of mind is that idea of news fatigue, right? Like the notion that people are not sharing like the many details of what happened today in impeachment. They're not spending a lot of time sharing, you know, every single micro update of the SNC-Lavalin story.
Right.
It makes sense that they'd be sharing the Bianca story. Like, that was, you know, that was a moment where the whole country was kind of like, yeah, this is our team.
Yeah.
I'm surprised to see the Raptors are not there, because that sort of felt like another one of those moments.
Yeah, it's definitely in the top 25, but it didn't make the top 10. So some of the other ones on the top 10 were Canadian air traffic controllers buying their American counterparts dinner during the U.S. Government shutdown. Trudeau's brown face incident is in the top 10. Don Cheadle's SNL Protect Trans Kids shirt was in the top 10. And vaping deaths, the stories around vaping deaths in the U.S. specifically and how Canadian officials are watching.
That's news.
Also in the top 10. Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it's
definitely proper news.
In my mind, it feels like, Brad, that it ladders back to things that people feel personally attached to. I think that that's probably the most logical reason why they'd be most engaging.
Potentially, or and as well, you know, you hear from a lot of news consumers that they want good news. They want to read good news, and then I'm sure newsrooms hear this a lot as well.
Yeah,
you know, this they're sick of the bad news and the controversy and everything. Give me something that's sort of makes me feel good that I can share with friends and family too, because they are, you know, as we've fatigued by you know what's going on in the U.S. and. You know, bad news generally, people are less likely to share, I think, unless they have some statement that they want to make or they want to mock it in some way.
Right.
But some of these stories, like this little dog, I have no idea.
We know dog stories do well. Like last year's number one story was, remember the three St. Bernards in Edmonton who were looking for a forever home, and that was like the biggest story. We all know dogs do well. I mean, so what... If this is the list that Canadians are sharing, what does it say, too, about how newsrooms are handling stories? Like, we know that newsrooms are looking at Chartbeat on the back end. They're optimizing stories. They're using AI to kind of make sure that the audience gets what it wants. So could this be a representation of how newsrooms are shifting their editorial stance to kind of lean in on the stories that people want to talk about versus the stories that maybe they need to know about?
There's a few ways to look at that, and I think the more important one to look at is, are newsrooms completely adjusting their behaviors and, you know, reorganizing their resources so they could find these good stories? I hope not. I hope that, you know, when these stories happen, like, every newsroom has a couple people who can maybe write something up on this.
Yeah.
But the notion that you'd become sort of in the business of doing that might be a disquieting kind of evolution of journalism, certainly would get you the engagement that you're seeking.
Yeah, I mean,
if these stories are sort of...
They need to make money, Elamine.
I know, and I understand that. but there are so many stories that, like the pipeline protest, not making that list.
No, of course not.
It's not a surprise, but also at the same time, like, it's a little disappointing, right?
Yeah. I mean, Brad, what should have been on there before we move on to PR disasters for the year? Which will also be a fun list.
I guess it depends where you're coming at it from. So the fact that Trump isn't on that is, to me, is shocking.
It says something, doesn't it, right?
Well, it is so... I really have trouble understanding what is going on down there with this particular president. The things that he says and he does every day are just beyond... comprehension. And so I think newsrooms also have, you know, they have a role to play. Obviously, they got to make money. I get that.
Yeah.
But you're, as a news consumer, you do rely on editors and others to sort of make those news value judgments on your behalf. And you can scroll through it, you can ignore it, you can do what you want with it. But, you know, where is the actual news versus those, you know, quote-unquote human interest type stories.
You know what I thought was fascinating, Elamine, is the day after the Trump impeachment decision by the House of Representatives in the U.S., most Canadian digital news fronts actually deprioritized the story. And we're looking at other things. And to me, that was shocking. Like, still, the front page of the Globe and Mail was still, was SNC-Lavalin, top of fold, and then Trump impeachment in the bottom. But to me, it was so surprising that the Trump impeachment, which is historic, it hasn't happened that many times in history, but it didn't really play in Canadian, not as much as I expected it to.
I mean, it also took 85 days, right? Like 85 days since the impeachment inquiry launched all the way up until the vote happened. That's 85 data points for editors to look at and be like, yeah, we have to cover this, obviously, but do people care that much that it's got to be served to them, you know, at the very front?
Right.
It did really well for us over at BuzzFeed. But that's not, I don't think that's especially surprising. Like, it's sort of been culminating up to this, but all the other, you know, sort of incremental updates of impeachment, they didn't do as crazy as that day. And I'm sure that everyone had, like, every newsroom across the board probably had a really big day, the day that that the House impeached Trump.
Yeah.
But then, like, is there a second day story? Like, no, there isn't. Like, the next thing that's going to happen with impeachment is going to be after the holiday break. It's actually quite a bit of a stretch out time. So
So you're saying it's understandable that it didn't really play that big in the next day, in the next day digital fronts. Like, the news goes so fast now, it makes sense that it wouldn't be that prominent.
And especially for the Globe, who kind of have been owning that SNC story, it makes sense for them to be like, let's put that up top.
But then you look at CNN, the only thing they cover is this president.
Yeah.
or hurricanes.
And their ratings have never been better, apparently, Brad.
It's wall-to-wall Trump.
Yeah, it's quite something. Okay, well, let's put Trump aside for a moment and let's talk about Yes, please.
Thank you.
Let's do that. PR snafus for the year, the PR moments where you're like, oh, man, that's bad. I have a list of moments that I thought, wow, we should really talk about them, but curious to hear yours first. So, Brad, what was like the most for you, the most troubling PR moment of the year that just made you go, oh my gosh?
So, I think, you know, the Prince Andrew interview was an interesting one for me. So, you know, the argument was always, the argument from PR people is, why would you have agreed to have done this interview? And I look at it a little differently. Say, actually, do the interview. It's what he said in the interview that is most problematic, or didn't say.
Yeah.
So there was an opportunity. We all know that it can take... it takes years to build a reputation and moments to destroy it. His reputation had already, it was already at a very low bar. I mean, so he had an opportunity here to start to rebuild it a little bit, if possible. I don't know. I don't know enough about the entire story.
Right. I think anybody does, frankly. There's still a lot of like question marks there.
So, but you know, from the PR world, all I kept hearing is why would he should never have agreed to do this. He should never. And I would come at it and say, do it, but you need to take an opportunity here to show some empathy, for God's sake. I mean, it's so basic. Now, if it's not authentic, then that's a problem.
Maybe don't do it.
So,
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if that's how he feels, then I guess, yes,
save him from himself, right? That's kind of, I don't know, Al. I mean, what did you think of that moment?
I think every quote that I read from that interview, I was like, who allowed him to continue to be in the room? It was just continued to be a mystery to me why anyone would let him speak. I assume he insisted to be the one to speak, that was poor communication.
And the interviewer it wasn't this Mike Wallace gotcha kind of interview. It was a conversation, and he just kept stepping in it. Preparation,
you got to be ready for these things, though, and we've talked about this off mic. You know, the facts of this case matter. And if he is in fact guilty of having done something or can't actually justify his behavior in this story, then any good PR person would keep him as far away from Mike as possible. I mean, the theory of containment, right? If you don't have anything good to offer in your own defense, then you should probably say nothing at all. So I'm kind of in the camp, Brad, of that dude should have just kept his mouth shut.
Well, or I, you know, what was the conversation leading up to the decision to agree to the interview say, you know, Your Royal Highness, you need to un-F yourself and get this and get it right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What about you, Al? I mean, what's your moment of the year where you're like, oh, my God?
Two moments come to mind. I'm not, I don't really think of them as PR disasters as they're happening, but later I'm like, no, you definitely didn't handle that properly.
Mm-hmm.
The first is Justin Trudeau on that plane the day that the brown face, black face story broke.
Yeah.
I, for a story that you conceivably knew was coming, that was not an especially prepared statement. That was not an especially comforting statement to see from a prime minister who, you know, I guess apparently like knew the consequences of what he had done. None of that kind of came through. I think
there was a drip too, like from that scrum to like a couple of others before they actually landed on something that was workable.
Right. Like when he did that sort of like the next day sort of afternoon.
Right. He's presser, like, no, now I've got it. I understand.
Yeah. And that was a bit mystifying to me.
It was,
you know, especially for a prime minister who claims to be very relatively well-versed in these things.
Right.
Then the other one is J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling, towards the end of the year, supporting this woman who got fired for her job for expressing some anti-trans views. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why J.K. Rowling would want to say anything out loud. And I just mean this, I guess, from a PR perspective, like, which doesn't do her any good.
Right.
Even if she held those views, she must have known how they're going to resonate with fans of her work, how it's going to become the sort of internet story of the day when she did that.
She did that on Twitter, right?
Yes.
With her Twitter comment. It's interesting, you know, often with principals or like leading people, there's no vetting process for tweets, right? So anybody can go from their brain to millions of people without much sober second thought.
Right.
So it was a surprising thing for her because she hasn't actually behaved like that in the past that I can recall.
I mean, many people have sort of been suspecting that she holds these views, but it's never been like particularly confirmed. And like, this is not a judgment on the views themselves, but it's just a presentation of it and knowing how younger fans of your work might relate to it. It was a surprising move, and by surprising I mean bewildering.
Brad, on those two fronts, the blackface issue for Trudeau, what was your takeaway from that whole incident?
So, you know, we hear a lot about transparency and the importance of transparency and being transparent and open and honest, or honest, open, and transparent.
Right.
You know, these phrases that we hang on to in this business that are oh so important. The other one that we often forget about, or that the people who are purporting to be transparent forget about, is accountability.
Right.
So if you're going to share views, or you're going to, you know, make a statement on an incredibly big story, and you want to be transparent, you also need to recognize that with that comes accountability.
Right.
And so how are you going to be how are you going to hold yourself accountable?
Right.
It's one thing to be transparent. Okay, now the next step is around accountability and repairing the damage that you've done.
It makes me think of Don Cherry and Don Cherry's firing, speaking of a lack of accountability.
So, you know, it's interesting. So the next day, Sportsnet put out a statement saying, we spoke with Don and we shared with Don that, you know, our disappointment. I can't remember the exact words.
Yeah.
It didn't go far enough because then, what, it was 2 days later, or maybe it was the Monday, I guess maybe 2 days later or the next day, then they fired him. And so it made me think after the fact, well, they actually tried to get him to do an apology, a real apology, not I apologize if I offended you, because that's not
just like
an
apology. The worst apology ever.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I regret any offense.
I'm so sorry I offended you, Elamy.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Just get over it.
Thanks. Really helps a lot.
Okay.
And so it felt to me like what Sportsnet were doing, what Rogers were doing, were was trying to buy themselves a little bit of time as they tried to get him to do what he absolutely needed to do, and he chose not to, and so they, you know, so then they had to pull the trigger eventually. But that's one of those where, you know, you sit back and you go, how would you or how should you have handled that differently? And I think by that point, I don't think, you know, having Don Cherry then apologize would have actually helped the matter. I think he had a long history of this, and his time had come well past this event.
Will Elamina's change hockey? Because there was a lot of conversation about, okay, finally, like, the shoe has dropped, Cherry's out. And there have been actually several coaches since who have, you know, had faced accountability for their actions. I mean, are we witnessing, I mean, I'm not a hockey expert by any stretch, but are we witnessing kind of a fundamental shift now post Cherry's firing? In hockey?
So I certainly can't speak to the hockey aspect of it, because that is not my sport.
Not your jam.
I'm a soccer person.
Yep.
However, what I can speak to is this notion of failing in public and the sort of higher bar of consequences. So there wasn't always this kind of high bar of consequences for whether it's coaches or just like public figures in general, who, when they make a mistake very publicly, they didn't really have to be accountable to it. And that is that has changed because you know, a brand like Sportsnet can see a sort of a mass of people being like, your apology is weak sauce, it's nothing, and feeling the pressure to have to do more. So that means that, like, being held accountable for your failure is a little bit easier now, and I don't know if that's a problem. You know, I don't know. Generally speaking, I don't know if that's a problem. Is that, you know, if you make such a high profile mistake, you should probably have to answer for it. You don't necessarily have to get fired or lose your job. But you certainly have to apologize in a way that makes people feel like understood.
Right.
And I think the NHL has been slow to this. I think they, the commissioner Gary Bettman, when you know the Mike Babcock issue came out, when the coach of the Calgary Flames issue came out, you know, issued a statement. I mean, it's taken them a while to sort of catch up, and it's always that, you know, hindsight. You know, what could and should we have done differently? I suppose I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that this was a new thing for them that they had to come, they have to come to terms with. And so I think overall it could be good for hockey. I know, you know, statements have been made by others about, you know, hockey being no longer you know, this middle class sport. It's actually quite expensive to play organized hockey. It takes a lot of money and time. You know, not like it was in the good old days. So is there an opportunity there for hockey to as a, you know, as both an amateur and professional sport to come to terms with its future?
Yeah, it's so interesting in this and in some of the other stories too. This year has been quite clear to me how quickly consequences can arrive at your door because of Twitter, because of this mass ability to pass judgment very quickly. Another really interesting example this year of one of those moments was the Peloton ad of the Peloton wife and her husband buying her the machine and her being really excited about it. And my favorite part about the Peloton ad was actually Ryan Reynolds and his hiring of the wife after for a gin ad, which was brilliant. What did we learn? And by the way, Peloton's stock completely tanked after that ad came out, which, you know, speaking of consequences, right? If you misstep in advertising, marketing, or PR, like the consequences can be quite substantial, quite substantial and surprising, you know?
Yeah, I think... The lesson there is if you cut an ad and you're really excited about it, maybe show it to a few people outside your company first. I can't imagine even watching a first draft of that, you know, a first cut, and seeing her face just full of concern and be like, yeah, this is the face that we want to put behind our company. Please buy our product. And so, I mean, she's come out and said that like, maybe it was her face that was a problem. And I'm like, no, it wasn't. It was the whole sort of setting. Very nice of her to try to take the bullet for them. But no.
When I first saw it, I honestly thought it was an SNL spoof.
Oh, really?
I really did. And, you know, and part of the cynic in me thought, did they do this on purpose to get all of that earned media? Was that a strategy?
Yeah, but because their stock tanked.
Well,
tanks,
that's a consequence that they perhaps, you know, in the risk assessment of doing this, because certainly I know at my time at the TTC, there were advertisers who would design and create ads knowing full well it was going to get more play in the media as a news story because of its whatever the strategy was in terms, or whatever the creative was, that it would, you know, people would call for it to be banned or you know, or to be taken down, or so they get all of this earned media. And so in the back of my mind, part of me was wondering if this wasn't a strategy on their part.
Now, just a bad ad.
You know, it could be as simple as that. But I'm not, because you got to think, you know, to your point, did they show it to be, I mean, there's a creative agency behind all of this.
It's honestly,
and they did that strategy.
It's why diversity, inclusion, and that kind of stuff in agencies like Edelman, we take this very seriously too. Like, if you're doing an ad about women and don't show your ad to women, you're going to have a problem. If you have another ad that has doesn't represent diversity, you're going to be insulted. Somebody possibly. So you're absolutely right. Like, maybe show somebody the ad.
Yeah.
Speaking of SNL skits, so my favorite was that NATO moment for sure. Did you watch the SNL skit that after Trudeau? Did you watch it?
The
they were all the cool kids in the high school cafeteria, and they were all sort of laughing by introspect.
That was the cold start, right?
Yeah, it was the cold start. Maybe we're just older. Do you watch SNL still?
I do on YouTube the next day sometimes. Okay. But not all the time. So.
So yes. lesson there, Brad.
Well,
seems obvious to me, but
every, you know, if there's a camera in the room or there's a microphone in the room, assume they're all hot.
Yep.
I mean, now I heard the Prime Minister yesterday on Power and Politics.
Oh yeah, watch that interview.
Explain, you know, what he was actually talking about, and
he said he wasn't making fun of the president.
You know,
so. I know.
We have a bilateral relationship with the United States. I mean, I
say I'm 6'5". You know?
I'll back you up on that.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think most Canadians probably support him on this. I mean, I'm sure that
Oh, will
sure
it have Donald negative has, consequences? No, I mean, they signed, they've got NAFTA. I mean, you know, there's it's a complicated relationship. It wasn't the end of the world, but
it's one of those crazy little sidebar stories that always come, and then they, you know, you forget about them later. It just became this moment.
Yeah.
It wasn't just him, of course. I mean, Johnson was there.
Yeah. Macron was there.
Princess Anne was there. I think it was the Prime Minister of Netherlands. So
He got away with this. You know, nobody's talking about him in the headlines. The Prime Minister of the Netherlands.
Right? No, lucky guy. Oh no, don't ask. Do you know that answer? You don't know.
I should know before.
Was
I ask.
Was it Netherlands or Denmark? I don't even remember.
Exactly. See, they're interchangeable almost. Yes. So, okay, so that's a lot of really good snafus to learn from this year. So let's look ahead to 2020. So I'd love to hear from you guys before I let you go. Two things. One is, what do you think is going to happen next year in terms of trends, especially in journalism and PR and our business, one? And two, what advice do you have for people in the spotlight moving into 2020 that they should start with predictions?
I predict that we're going to maybe slow down the news cycle a little bit.
How does that work?
Because the way that we lived for the past 10 years has not been sustainable. I don't think anyone feels more informed. I don't think anyone feels like they understand the world better, like they understand each other better. I genuinely think that journalists will find a way to be like, okay, we need to spend a bit more time on this story. Mm. Now I say this, but also next year's 2020, like the election in the US. So maybe you're like, oh, I mean, you're completely off base on this. It's only going to get faster. In which case, please don't tell me that, because it will just make me panic. I can't take another year.
No. It sounds like you need a break, like a digital detox break.
Desperately.
Over the holidays.
Yes, 100%.
That would be good. What about you, Brad?
I think local news is going to need to find itself, especially local TV.
I mean, I've heard it's just going to fall off a cliff. Like we're very close to the news, like the news brands dropping their appointment viewing television.
There's so much breaking news, right? I mean, what constitutes break? I mean, everything's breaking news now, it seems. It's either breaking or it's long form, thoughtful pieces. Mm-hmm. But I think local has an opportunity, especially around diversity, to tell those kinds of stories that we talked about off the top that are unique, that are, you know, shareable, if I can use that word, especially in cities like Toronto, the most diverse city in the world, where there are so many stories out there that are worthy of being told, and audiences out there that clearly have a hunger for. How do you deliver that? I have no idea. If I had the answer, I'd be a billionaire.
Yeah, I don't know, Elamine, any thoughts on that? I mean, local TV, I mean, in the U.S. has definitely gone off a cliff. There's been there's really significant news deserts here in Canada also. From my standpoint, I just see it getting worse and worse. I mean, we see now the, you know, Toronto Star, the Metro papers are gone, and we're running out of options here.
We do talk about this as though it's like some kind of mystical process that doesn't involve consumers. And I think at a certain point, we just have to wait for consumers to start demanding more local news.
What if they don't? What if they don't?
Yeah, then we're in deep shit.
Yeah, right? And I would argue that's where we are now.
Right.
Like, that's where I feel like we are now.
And so that's the worry. I think the worry is an increasingly comfortable consumer who's not seeing themselves locally represented in the news that they consume, and they're okay with that.
Yeah.
And if that is, in fact, the future we're headed to, we haven't, and by we, I mean just like the journalism institution, has not adjusted to a conception of itself without that.
Yeah.
Because one of the very founding principles is people care about where they're living and they want to know what's happening there.
Yeah.
And if that's gone, then I don't know what happens next.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's lots to worry about, I guess.
I mean, you know, if it bleeds, it leads is, I think, will always be part of local TV news.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then they quickly need to move on to, I think, you know, more stuff thoughtful analytical kinds of pieces about why is it bleeding?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we'll see. We'll wait and see if the industry responds the way that it needs to actually survive.
There are some creative solutions. Like I saw, so TVO, for example, they're doing these
news hubs.
I
love the news hubs. Yeah.
So, They have reporters sort of set up in different parts of Ontario. It's like, hey, you're a reporter, and like we understand that there isn't enough in one city to generate all the news, but like maybe you cover a region, maybe you cover you know, four or five different cities, and maybe they have a relationship because everything that they're experiencing in the region, kind of, they kind of experience it together.
Right.
And that's to me like an example of a successful experiment.
Yeah.
In the quality of journalism is producing.
Yeah.
In terms of the numbers, I don't know. I don't know if TVO is seeing smashing numbers from their regional hubs. You know, I doubt it, but also I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, CBC obviously will continue to fill that gap. Also, even though there's been layoffs in CBC Toronto, also, I mean, this year was the year of layoffs for sure.
Yeah,
we just saw more and more bleeding, so it's been a really challenging year, I think, for those people in the business. And in fact, you know, PR people to journalists in Canada now is like a 9-to-1 ratio. There's a lot of us, Brad.
That's alarming.
Out there, I know. It's a little alarming.
And that's what journalists say, that's alarming. That frightens me. And it's, and I think if we, you know, that's that older relationship, if you will, of the, you know, the PR person versus, not versus, but, and journalists, that's all PR does, that old concept that you just work with journalists and media relations.
Which it isn't anymore. We're integrated.
It's storytelling. Stories, exactly.
Yeah, going straight to audience, Elamine, is what we're doing.
Right. And then, so that's where that difference is. So there is that, you know, and so I think, you know, in terms of a trend, I think we'll start to see more and more of that, that storytelling direct to the public. Not to say, and you still need to deal with reporters and journalists, because there are still going to be issues and things that occur that you're going, especially in government, that you're going to need to address that you can't address directly, obviously. Right. But
presumably that cuts both ways, in the sense that the stories that companies or organizations might tell have a certain vantage point, you know, like a sort of a loaded interest vantage point that a reporter might be like, yeah, but there's this whole other...
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It will be a very interesting space to watch for sure. Yeah. So last question before we say goodbye to 2019. For those people who find themselves in the public eye, whether it be on Twitter or in interviews, companies, corporations, journalists, what is your sort of takeaway piece of advice going into 2020 on surviving this crazy media landscape and all of the stuff that we've witnessed this year?
Preparation. Be prepared. We talked about this a little bit earlier. It just, you know this is going to happen. If there are issues out there that have yet to become public that you know are festering and percolating, get in front of it, own it, you know, all of those things. That it's easy to, of course, sit here and say all of that to somebody who's in the crosshairs.
Right.
You got to convince them that this is a long game, often, around reputation and dealing with bad news.
Mm-hmm.
How you deal with it out the gate, you're going to take hits, absolutely, but when the public... Your shareholders, your consumer, whomever, look back. How did you handle it out the gate? Did you then have to, you know, backtrack? And did you have, you know, so
do the right
thing. Transparent, right? Do the right thing. It's that transparency with accountability.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's great advice, Brad. Elamine.
I would say that we spent a few years and probably a decade learning how to talk on those platforms, learning how to speak. Now we got to figure out what to say. And I think the larger problem is there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of people who are just adding to the noise all the time. Totally myself included. Half my tweets, God, definitely someone should delete them. I'm not going to, but someone should.
You could just end of the decade cleanse.
Yeah.
Just go back in and just hit delete.
They're all very valuable.
Okay,
no, I'm joking.
Sorry.
I think there's real merit in just kind of thinking about the role that you occupy in whatever space you're in. And how you can actually add value to it instead of just adding more to the noise. Because, God, can we just move away from the sheer volume of information that is not that useful to people or that people are, like, not asking for? I think sometimes differentiating between something that is going to actually bring some kind of value to a person versus a thing that you just need to say.
Yeah. Restraint.
Yeah, some kind of restraint, some kind of filter in understanding what your role is in that space.
Right.
But you want to have fun too, right? I mean, I wouldn't want to take that piece away because, a lot of tweets.
Fun has value.
Fun is good. People do love it for sure.
True.
Yeah. Right?
Right. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, from a news consumer, you know, being real and all of those things and just having a little bit of fun and having a sense of humor, I think has great value for sure.
Well, I think that's some pretty good advice from the both of you. And I just want to thank you for the smart stuff and wish you all the best in 2020, guys.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to continue the conversation, find us on Twitter. Brad is at Brad Ross TO, Alamine is at Alamine88, and I'm at Sophie Netto.